Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast.
All right, so welcome back to Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. Again, I'm kicking off the beginning here of season three. We got Tony King back on the podcast, one of my favorite people to talk to because I really enjoy his perspective on things. I think he's got one of the fresh perspectives that isn't fresh in the unrealistic sense. It's fresh in a realistic sense. And so, Tony, just real quick, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you coming on again today with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's always lovely to talk. Thanks.
All right. So today, Tony just had a paper recently come out I wanted to talk to him about. It came out in the Journal of Strategic Studies. It's called Robot Wars, Autonomous Drone Swarms, and the Autonomous Drone Swarms in the Battlefield of the Future. And it came out on March 4th in the Journal of Strategic Studies. And so I want to talk a bit about that real quick. And then I wanted to hit also, you tweeted some stuff about the Russo-Ukrainian War not too long ago. I wanted to get your thoughts on that also before we close out. So a decent amount of ground to cover in a short amount of time. So we'll push to get through it quickly. So we'll jump right in on the paper here. And I'm going to start off with a quote from the paper because I think that the paper is terrific. And I'm going to start with the quote to then pass the baton over to you, Tony, to ask you some about the paper. And so the quote from the paper that I thought was terrific was, and it's the problem with the current literature is that it predicts a revolution on the basis of thin, narrowly selected evidence, which only supports the case for transformation while ignoring the limitations of drones as a weapon. And so I think that that's a really good place to start when we discuss this paper and discuss the ideas really within this paper. And so in the paper, Tony, you lay out three fallacies that exist within the literature. So if you would walk us through those fallacies and why those fallacies are important as we think about drones and drone swarms and in modern and future armed conflict.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it might be worth just saying some context to the paper. So the paper started out as a more general criticism of the work on artificial intelligence. And then, of course, a lot of that work, the minute you mention the word AI, everyone thinks that you're talking about autonomy. And once you're talking about autonomy, one is immediately drawn into drone swarms. And that's the evolution of the paper. That's how it came from AI, which is the master topic, and I've just completing a book on that, and then on to autonomy, and then on to drone swarms. Yeah, I mean, essentially, I started out, I mean, I'm not a sort of military technologist. I've written very little about military technology. I mean, I'm a human sociologist of a very traditional type, an anthropologist, sociologist of a traditional type, and I'm not an expert in science and technology studies. I don't profess to have that expertise in technology. But as I started to read the literature on AI, and that meant on autonomy and therefore on drone swarms, the three things just get completely conflated. things started to bother me quite quickly about these presumptions that you've articulated. And that sentence is I think, the most important sentence in the paper about the evidential basis of some of this stuff.
Yeah.
And essentially, I came to a claim, and which was three fallacies, essentially, is that, firstly, unless there's some kind of unimaginable revolution in drone technology, the kinds of capabilities which are imputed to drones and by extension to drone swarms are vastly exaggerated. We could talk about this more, but drones are slow. Even if they swarm, their actual ordnance, the destructive capability is going to be much less than people think. A military commander, I think, would much prefer to put a HIMARS or a TLAM missile on top of something than a drone swarm carrying a few kilos of, each one carrying 2 kilos of explosives. And of course, the important point here is also is that there's the vision that they will be able to swarm seamlessly through the most complicated battlefield, that, you know, an urban battle space, through the smoke and the debris and all the hellish confusion of it all, somehow the drone, like Terminator, will be able to transcend the difficulties and complexity. Well, there's no evidence for it in contemporary automation, that even the most advanced autonomous systems are capable of that kind of sophisticated targeting. So first point, first fallacy is that the capabilities are vastly, and the projections of the capabilities are vastly exaggerated. Now, just as a footnote, I am not in any way saying drones aren't important. Remote drones, first-person view drones are not important. It's manifestly the case from the fight against ISIS, from the ISIS usage of them and the fight against them, right through the Nagorno-Karabakh war, right through to Ukraine and to the Houthis now, drones are important. Yeah. But there's an exaggeration. Second fallacy, and this is obviously intimately related to the first fallacy. The second fallacy is that, therefore, other weapon systems will just become irrelevant. Essentially, traditional weapon systems, tanks, armored vehicles, human fighters will just become irrelevant. And for me, this just, it's just palpably, there's just, you can make that claim, but there's just no evidence for it. I mean, look at Ukraine, where, you know, the Rusi figure on it, Ukrainians in 2022 were expending 10,000 drones a month. The first-person view drone, notably taking up for the gap in artillery, has become completely ubiquitous. Yeah, but it's a weapon system. It's just another weapon system. In fact, we might even say it's less than a weapon system. In many cases, it's a piece of ordnance. And the notion that that piece of ordnance or that weapon system is going to displace and substitute every other single weapon system, rifles, machine guns, tanks, artillery pieces of various caliber and various function, for me, it's just science fiction. My third point is, and I think here there's been much more, you know, a lot more people starting to express skepticism, is the presumption, and this is based on, this goes back to the capability. If you operate with a vision that drone swarms will be massive, will be programmed to be unstoppable, will be infinitely agile, and they will be automated, so the decision making will be absolutely instantaneous. It will work at the speed of light, at computer speed. Then the natural assumption, which is very, very sedimented in the literature, is of course AI will enable the offense. It will be the ultimate form of maneuver, because there'll be no risk of loss. AI will rationally calculate the risks. It will attack, it will preempt, and it will have this physical capability with drone swarms of flying to wherever it wants to and destroying any target. Well, the evidence from drones, is even for the last 20 years, is quite the opposite. And I think even more so in terms of autonomous drone swarms, that actually they'll enable a defense. That a defender armed with autonomous drone swarms, so they can put autonomous drone swarms to hover over key areas of advance are far more likely to be effective than attacking ones, especially since the defenders are going to be fortified and camouflaged into positions that are difficult to spot and to target. So for me, as the remote sort of transformation, the remote revolution goes on, and we've seen this in Nagorno-Karabakh and especially in Ukraine, and I think it will, if autonomous drone swarms do become an effective weapon system, and they may become an effective supporting weapon system, though I've got some skepticism on that, in the land environment. Maritime, I think, is an interesting one to discuss. Yeah. I think the defense, once again, it'll be another factor that will glaciate contemporary land warfare and vitiate the attempts at maneuver. So for me, essentially, the three claims that now have sort of embedded themselves as conventional wisdom within the literature, and indeed even with talking to some military personnel, military professionals, I'm afraid to say I end up on the other side of the fence. I mean, I might say once again, you know, I just don't, I may be wrong, but I just don't see the evidence. And to go back to the original quote, you know, when one is, you know, it's that famous Yogi Berra thing, you know, prediction is difficult, especially about the future. When one is predicting about the future, you need to be really careful with your evidence. Maybe autonomous drone swarms will take over, but in the land environment, I'm really skeptical. And all of the weight of evidence seems to be on the skeptical side, even though that's the minor voice in the literature.
You know, it's funny that you say being on the wrong side of things again, or the wrong side of the arguments. You know, it reminds me of the conversation we had previously on here, and how, you know, the National Training Center was trying to prove you and I wrong on our thoughts on maneuver. So, I'm sure, you know, they'll be out here sooner or later trying to prove you wrong on drones as well. I know they're already trying to integrate drones they are integrating drones and what they're doing in drone swarms. So a couple thoughts on some of the things you said. It's interesting that you talked about the drones trying to operate in urban areas and get to places and do the pinpoint accurate attacks at you know, people think that we'll be able to do in the future. There's been some work with some companies on that stuff, and I know because I've chatted with them in an informal capacity, and they've shown me some of the stuff that they've worked on, and it is a step away from science fiction. And I'm not like criticizing their work in a negative sense. It's just so challenging that, like, outside of making some slides that say, "See, look, we're looking at it and we're working on it," I just don't think that the hard science is quite there yet. And again, I say that as a dude that's nowhere in that kind of hard science, but, you know, they're like, "Oh, what do you think about this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I mean, if you could make it work, that'd be cool." But, you know, they're like, "Oh yeah, it's really hard and we're trying to make it work." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm sure it is really hard." The other thing that I think is important that I think folks forget about, that I think you highlighted, that I'll just say in another way, is a lot of the drones are just another element in my assessment of combined arms. You know, it's not something nascent. It's not a game change. That's the other thing too. Game changing, that actually means something. If the game hasn't been changed, then it's not really game changing. And drones haven't changed any game. Drones are just another element of combined arms, you know, or they're just another toy within the kit bag, depending on how you think about combined arms. And I think you could label them either way. They're just another element of combined arms, or they're just another type of, you know, somewhere along the scale of munition, to a degree. And so when I hear folks talk about how drone, and I've got books over on my shelves that talk about how drones are game changing, you know, because I have to read, you know, I like to read the scale of things so that I can appreciate both sides of the argument. Some of those books, I just want to bang my head against the wall when I'm reading.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things where it's not necessarily, that's not necessarily the case. And the other thing that I think is challenging, and I think it's funny, when I was reading the paper too, you talk about some of the things you're talking about when you're talking about automated decision-making and Google and some of the automated the attempts to make things autonomous and inject autonomy into these systems, right? You know, like I spend a lot of time in downtown Austin, Texas, because I, you know, worked down there. And so you see a lot of Teslas running around and all these cars that they're trying to make run by themselves. And you see them going down the road without a person in them. And trust in AI is not a high thing, you know, when you see those things go putting by. And I think that's something that's on the end of the person that's not using it, but then also on the end of the person that's using it, that will take a significant amount of time to increase over time. And then the other thing, and I think there's two more things, and I'll pass it back over to you. I think that there's, you know, as you talk about the munition size, the ordnance size, right? And I'm looking at this part in the paper right now, actually. It says, even if drone swarms are programmed to target successfully, drones will not be as lethal as many have claimed. Their ordnance is just too small. And that's what I think, you know, a lot of the videos that people are showing on YouTube and whatnot, it's this $1 million shot where, you know, this drone drops the, whatever it is, this grenade into the hatch of a tank. And I'm always surprised that they're able to drop that thing, whatever it is, into the hatch so perfectly, because it, you know, the hatch on a tank's not very big. And it's always like this $1 million shot, you know, that they get. And, but it's, that's the thing, like those drones can't carry very big munitions. And so, if you've got drone swarms, in most cases, those are smaller drones that aren't going to be able to carry very big things. And so they're going to be able to go swarm, drop a few things, and then they're going to have to fly away. Unless they sit in the area to fly around and harass, but in which case, I think that gets to my last point here. We're, you know, I think this idea of the challenge response dynamic is an important thing to consider when we think about conflict, right? And so there's always a challenge presented, and then the other combatant always works through the response aspect of things. And so on the drone side, we're still collectively, I think, big picture, most folks are still on the challenge side, right? The challenge is being presented, but the counter drone side, that response side, is still not really, it's very, very much in its nascent stage, because everybody's like, ooh, cool, look at all these drones, let's make our drones. And so right now we're caught up with the novelty of the drone itself, and we the collective we, like the just the everybody, hasn't really thought through good ways to counter the drone. And so I think that that's part of the problem too, is right now we're just so focused on, and this is why I think you're right too on the defense, you know, like drones sitting there hovering over a defended position, you know, that to me that's just like a buzzsaw waiting to be walked into. And so anyway, I'm just curious if you have any other thoughts on that before we jump over to to Russia, to Ukraine. I mean,
you know, as always, your responses are really interesting and pertinent. I mean, I'd just say a couple of things. I mean, what you know, it's important, it seems to me, to be realistic.
Yeah.
But one needs to be careful about not being a sort of Luddite. I mean, I do think that, you know, drones have become an important part of the armory. And I think that is likely to develop. And so I wouldn't want to be saying, oh, you know, I mean, there's various schools of military history of everything was great in 1944 and it's all been downhill since then, or there's nothing new ever. Yeah. And, you know, for me, what's interesting about the current suite of drones and the, say, in 5 years, workable drone swarms of, I don't know, 20 to 50 vehicles, you know, are capable of being deployed into a company group or a battalion, something like that. You know, I mean, there seems to me it's incumbent upon us as analysts to not be beguiled and bewitched by those, but also not to say, oh, nothing's new in war, it's all the same, you know, and it's that balance. Yeah. And I don't think that's easy to get. I mean, I absolutely think that drones accentuate some of the trends in land warfare. They're just another bit of the armory. Mm-hmm. I think there are certain things that they have done which do change some tactics and change some of the organizational structures with.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare.
That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Then, you know, we're talking about land warfare now within platoons, companies. You know, one of the things they do, which is interesting, is at platoon level, they turn platoon. So platoon commanders in the past used to think in two dimensions, essentially. Left, right, flank, in the middle. And now they've got to think in three dimensions. That's interesting. You know, that so the you're no longer got an air, you know, a tactical area of responsibility. You've got a space as responsibility as a junior commander. That is interesting to me. And I think it does present a requirement for perhaps a certain amendation of land doctrine from platoon tactics upwards, and a potential amendation of the way the command of a platoon is organized. It'd be very interesting to see how the Ukrainians and the Russians have dealt in a command way at platoon, company, battalion, brigade level with the fact that the airspace below, you know, where airspace was something above, you know, the height of, of helicopters or planes, so quite high, thousands of feet. Now there's an airspace of hundreds of feet, which you've got to think about. And I think so. Those kind of things seem to me to be deeply interesting, precise questions to ask without going, oh, the whole thing, you know, I'm certainly not dismissing it, but we've got to be realistic and we've got to be based on observation and evidence and care. So that's where I would be. And, you know, as I say, as you said, with the ordnance and also with the challenge, the thing is, in terms of the military, you've got to also think, well, the enemy is going to be pretty quickly armed with these. And that changes what the land, you can't just think about land warfare and its development from looking at you possessing the weapon. I mean, it's very noticeable. Those hilarious sort of videos. I mean, the ridiculous Russell, you know, Stuart Russell one, Slaughterbots, which everyone sort of has influenced even the military discussion. They're against civilians' targets. One looks at the drones drawn going into the lecture theatre. My response to that was, why didn't someone just shut the door? You know, it's, you know what I mean?
That's right.
So one has to, if one wants to be serious about it, you've got to think about both sides possessing the technology or counters to the technology to understand the direction. And for me, at that point, you really do come to this thing as it changes something. I mean, it's not nothing, just as, you know, weapons in the past have changed something, but it's not. It's probably less than the machine gun. That's what I would potentially say. Probably less than the machine gun. But it's not, but I'm not disparaging it like that. It's important.
It's funny you say that too. Well, I was just going to say real quick, it's funny too, because I think today most people don't appreciate how much the machine gun actually was revolutionary in its day, you know? Whereas today, like when you say that, like that goes in one ear and out the other for most people, but it actually was a significant revolution.
Yeah, for sure. And interestingly, there's an interesting paper in that. You know, what does the machine gun initially do? It initially supports defense. It demands a transformation of organizational structures. It's, you know, you could make an interesting parallel between the two things. Though, as I say, I think probably the machine gun is more important. Let's see. And as I say, I suspect, you know, obviously I was critical of people in a small C sense. I respectfully critical of some scholars who I've got a lot of time for and some of whom are friends of mine, but it seems to me one has to engage in these debates and respectfully and politely take a different view from where some of the literature is going.
Yeah, no, that's fair. With that, we'll go ahead and transition. I want to get your take not your take, your assessment on where the war in Ukraine is at this point. You had a really good Twitter feed. It's a little out of date. I don't know if out of date's the right phrase now. It's a little old at this point, probably still valid, but you know, we tried to link up a little earlier, but timing and schedules didn't work out. So I would just be interested to hear what your current assessment is on the conflict and where you think it's headed. Because I think a lot's changed. I would say even in the past couple of weeks, it seems like a lot's changed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think this comes back to the discussion we just had about the priority of defense in contemporary warfare. I mean, my interpretation, I mean, there's been quite a lot of action activity, especially on the political and strategic front in the last 2-3 weeks. I mean, I must say, the sort of tweet that I put out that actually did generate some considerable responses.
I bet you got a lot of hate mail for that.
I got a few autonomous drone swarms coming my way, you know, whether they were automated or real people, I'm not quite sure. But I gotta say, I know it might upset listeners and lead to another round of counter battery fire or whatever one calls it, but I'm afraid to say I pretty much support. I would still hold on to the line that I took, that the balance of power in terms of combat power has shifted to the Russians. I don't think the Russians are capable of a massive offensive which would collapse significant parts of the Ukrainian armed forces. But I think that, and we're in now what I would say is the sixth phase of the war, a Russian counter-offensive phase. I think that they will continue to grind out advances, and I think it will be very difficult this year for the Ukrainian armed forces to stop them. And there's no planned, I mean, obviously operational security has been very good on the Ukrainian side, but there's no planned counter-offensive. And what's more significant, there doesn't look like there's any capability either in terms of force numbers or equipment artillery to actually mount another offensive. So then you go into 2025. Well, I know Michael Kaufman and his colleagues have written about perhaps more judiciously and wisely than I have, pretty similar position, but saying there might be a counteroffensive in 2025. Yeah, it might be. I am skeptical about the outcome of that, given unless there's a massive change in combat powers, or a massive upload, you know, in a certain kind of capability, air or artillery, I can't see how the Ukrainians could really massively transform the operation environment, i.e. breach those very significant defences and inflict a very serious defeat on the Russians. So they'd have to take a town like Tokmak or, of course, Melitopol. And I think that's going to be very difficult to do. I mean, I absolutely, you know, support the Zelensky government and the armed forces in Ukraine, absolutely. But I think they've got into a position where, you know, they're fighting against a major power who is determined to hold on to their ground and is not constrained by democratic niceties or, in many cases, by the laws of armed conflict. It's going to be very difficult to remove them, unpalatable that is. And it becomes more difficult in the light of the potential Trump election. Trump may continue to support Kyiv, but we just don't know. The fact is that wing of the Republican Party are not there. So for me, I see continuing conflict for at least another 12 months, 14 months at least, and it could go on longer. But I've never thought the war would end before 2025. I, you know, this is the bit that I got trolled about, is I think it's going to be very difficult for Ukraine to reintegrate its territory. That is a totally justified. It is a legitimate, completely to be supported a goal. But when we develop a strategy, we've got to actually think what's realistic. And I'm not sure that goal, although it is completely justified on every level, I'm not sure whether it's militarily achievable. So then the question is, right, if it's not militarily achievable, what are we actually pursuing? What are we going to actually put our resources towards? And my fear is, and we can start to see it in certain skepticism in bits of Europe And of course, in the radical wing of the Republican Party, well, if there's no clear outcome, no clear victory, what's the point in supporting them at all? And that is where I really, you know, that concerns me. Absolutely, it's our democratic requirement, our strategic requirement. It's in our interest to completely support Kyiv, but it's got to be planned in a way that's actually going to create an end, mm-hmm. which is the best possible outcome. Unfortunately, we don't live in a Panglossian world. I don't think the best possible outcome is going to be what all of us and what the Ukrainians, of course, rightfully want. I just don't see how that's going to be possible. So that's where I am. And, you know, in terms of the land warfare dimension, I can't see a way around that. I mean, I'm only a civilian. Maybe, you know, maybe there's a brilliant military general who can see a way of doing it. I must say I'm skeptical, but my skepticism is purely military. It's not in terms of what's justified, what's legitimate, what's politically optimal. But that's where I would be. I'm afraid to say I would hold on to, you know, I would affirm in the face of quite a lot of trolling the claims that I made.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I think that, again, like I've done every time I talk about this, I'm right there with you in terms of, like, I fully want Ukraine to win the conflict. I want Ukraine to get their territory back. But realistically, I don't think that that's at this time feasible. It goes back to like math, you know, in many cases, like they just don't have the land forces and the fires capability necessary. Again, I think it goes back to the game of Risk. And I know I've said this 1,000 times on this podcast. It's like when you play Risk, you don't just wish your way across the board. You have to physically conquer a territory, move land forces in after having defeated that army that's in that territory. And then you got to keep, you got to keep moving forward and taking territory, and you can't just vacate that territory when you take it. And I think that that's what a lot of people forget is that it's when you're doing this, you have to, like, for the Ukrainians, they either have to physically go in and, like, eradicate the Russians that are occupying that territory, or they have to do something that causes the Russian forces to flee that territory, or they have to do something politically that causes the Russian government to withdraw those forces. All of those three things are significant and not something that are easy to come about, right? And so
the physics are there. I mean, what I would say is the Ukrainians need to be supplied to exert punitive, you know, absolutely devastating punitive costs on the Russians, forcing them to a settlement that is as good as it can be for Ukraine. And part of that settlement, of course, and this is where I also disagree with some of the, it's interesting, some of the sort of Ukrainian maximalists then are skeptical about the NATO membership. I did not think NATO membership was sensible before the war. I did think it was potentially a provocation. I thought the Bucharest 2008 summit, I thought that was badly handled. I thought it was a mistake. I thought given that the West were not going to support Ukraine, it was a mistake at that point to articulate a kind of affiliation with Ukraine. If you're not going to back it up, don't make this statement. But what I do think now, and this is, you know, I just can't see any way to guarantee Ukraine's security once we arrive at peace without making it a NATO country and then securing its prosperity by making it an EU country. So, that is where I actually think that their calls for NATO membership, Russia sitting on the Dnipro River, I think that requires, if they remain sitting on the Dnipro River, it requires NATO membership where Russia will not come across, and they'll not come across, frankly, because of the Americans and the nuclear threat of coming across under an Article 5. I see that as, you know, it's a poor new security architecture. You know, it's a dangerous security architecture of Europe, but it seems to me the better one of the options the better one available post this conflict, post this war?
There's got to be something backside whenever this wraps up, however it wraps up, because, you know, there's several analogies throughout history that you can point to, you know, like what do you got in North Korea, South Korea, you know, you've got that DMZ. I think you'll have some sort of DMZ type thing going on. But yeah, I think if there's not something in place that's hard and reinforced by credible forces, Russia's at some point down the road, Russia's going to come back, because if you just go look at their history throughout forever, that's always been the case between those two states, unfortunately. Yeah. All right.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess that's we're short on time today, Tony. So is there anything else you've got before we break today?
You know, I'm finishing this book on AI. It'll be out. Unfortunately, it'll take a little bit of time to get published. It's an academic publisher. I'm very happy with who it is with. It'll be out next year. But I mean, that's what I've been working on and found it fascinating. And the argument is pretty similar to here. It's an essay about AI and warfare. And the essential argument is, warfare is not going to be automated, but AI is going to become an important part of some aspects of military function. And what I've tried to do in the book is to identify where AI has been harnessed and is being applied by certain military forces, and is being applied in very important ways. But a sort of full terminator automation of war is not what we need to be thinking about. We need to be more precise about where the applications lie. And as I say, they are significant and they are generating fascinating organizational changes, in my view.
The scary part, though, is you said we need to be precise to not create the terminators. And unfortunately, laziness is part of the human condition. So we might accident our way into the terminators.
Well, we may do. My fear is that if the West set themselves automation as the goal, they'll make themselves militarily less competitive than a human-centric force which harnesses AI for very specific functions. And at this point where the West is effectively fighting a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, a proxy war against Iran in the Red Sea, and perhaps in other parts of the Middle East, and a growing tensions in the Pacific, misunderstanding what we are trying to do and what generates actual combat power is a dangerous situation to be in.
Yeah. All right. Well, look forward to the book, and certainly we'll have you back on once that comes out. I know it's going to be a while, but look forward to picking it up. And if you need a reviewer, let me know. I'm happy to do a review for
I'll get you a copy without question. All right. It's great to speak as always, and thanks for having me on. It's always great. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Tony. We'll talk later.
Cheers, Amos. See you later. Yeah, bye now.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are a lot of other podcasts competing for your time, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you would share this podcast on social media, to include Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. Also, we would also appreciate it if you would give us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify Podcasts so that it makes us easier for new listeners to find. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.